thank everybody else for joining as well. We have a lot going on this month, and I'm not just talking about with the coronavirus and everybody staying put and on the down low, but March is National Nutrition Month as well as National Kidney Month. So what better way to celebrate both campaigns, but to combine them and give an education session on successful nutrition strategies for kidney failure. The main objectives that I'm going to cover today are first to describe the anatomical features of the kidneys and the physiological function. I thought it would be a good idea to start with a brief review. And then, as well as define and understand the diagnosis of acute kidney injury and chronic kidney disease. When we're dealing with our kidneys, there are a lot of things to talk about, but I figured I would focus specifically on acute versus chronic disease because the nutrition requirements for each one are different. So the other thing that we're going to do is review the nutrition requirements of patients with each acute kidney injury and chronic kidney disease and discuss how those requirements can change once dialysis is initiated. And then specifically with chronic kidney disease, we're going to cover mineral and bone disorder. But a pop quiz just came in, and so let me read this to you. You're a preceptor, and the dietetic intern asks you what the functional unit of the kidney is. And your answer is A, glomerulus, B, loop of Henle, C, nephron, or D, medulla. Now, if it's been a while since you've even heard those terms, then it's a good thing that we're going to review the anatomy and function. But the answer is C, nephron. If you take a look at this picture, I'm going to draw your attention first to the left, top left of the screen. So there you will see two bean-like organs. Those are your kidneys, and they are no bigger than the size of your fist. And they are located in the retroperitoneal space. So if you put your hands on your back and feel your ribs and follow your ribs all the way down to the very last rib, the 12th rib, that's where your kidneys, that's where you can find your kidneys. They sit right behind the rib cage there. So the kidneys contain over a million nephrons. That is the functional unit of the kidney. And blood is going to flow from, here's the vena cava. Blood is actually going to flow from the vena cava to the right side of the heart. Then it's going to be pumped from the right side of the heart through the pulmonary artery to the lungs, where it's going to pick up oxygen and then travel to the left side of the heart, where it's going to then be pumped through the aorta and then down to the kidneys. And then it's going to come here to the glomerulus. This is primarily there to filter blood, and then it's going to travel to the proximal tubule, where a number of different activities, reabsorption, secretion, metabolism, it happens, and then it's going to go through the loop of Henle and then to the distal tubule, and there's a lot of fluid resorption there, a lot of electrolyte and fluid regulation, and then it's going to go through the ductal, the collecting duct, and that's where it's concentrated and formed into urine. So that whole process is there to make urine, and the urine collects in this pelvic region and then is excreted through the ureter. Now, the kidneys, as being as small organs as they are, have a ton of functions within our bodies, and if we didn't have them, we certainly would miss them and eventually die. So, like I mentioned before, the one function is excretory, as well as acid-base balance. The kidneys play a huge role in maintaining the blood pH at 7.4. There's an endocrine function, and that that is responsible for taking the inactive form of vitamin D and activating it. And that's responsible for healthy bones, as well as activating certain hormones or hormone synthesis, such as erythropoietin, which is responsible or used in the production of red blood cells. And as we mentioned when we were covering the structure and function, the fluid and electrolyte balance, that role that the kidneys play as well. When your kidneys don't work and they shut down immediately, that's called acute kidney injury, and that can happen within 48 hours. That decline in kidney function is noted with a spike in your serum creatinine level and possibly and or a decrease in your urine output, as well as possibly noting some fluid on board as swelling. If your kidneys shut down more slowly, chronic kidney disease is more of a slow, progressive decrease in renal function. And that is usually caused by another chronic condition, such as diabetes, hypertension. It's actually the long-term damage of high blood sugar levels and the high blood pressure that causes damage to the actual kidneys. And if enough nephron functions decline, then you start to lose kidney function, and you can start to see the side effects of that as more and more start to shut down. With chronic kidney disease, it's usually irreversible, although you can slow down the progression or delay it by participating in healthy lifestyle changes. With acute kidney injury, it can sometimes be caused by an infection or a medication, or if there's a hemorrhage in their septic shock, then those are some of the causes, and it's often reversible. If you can get to the cause and remove it, a lot of times the kidney function will come back, and sometimes it requires renal replacement therapy to do that, but it's usually reversible. With chronic kidney disease, like I said before, it's not reversible, and as it progresses long enough, it eventually does require dialysis. So both chronic and acute kidney injuries can be classified differently. So with acute kidney injury, there's three subgroups, and it's based on where the insult to the injury occurs. So if the insult to the injury happens prior to the or before the kidney, then it's called prerenal. If it happens to the actual kidney, then it's called intrarenal. And if it happens post-kidney, then it's post. So an example of prerenal, when I was going through the structure of the kidney and with the blood flow, if there's any sort of shut off to that blood flow, there is a major hemorrhage or there's a blood clot, then that's happening, that's occurring prior to the kidney, and it's preventing blood perfusion to the kidney. And without blood flow or without oxygen, those nephrons in that kidney is going to shut down. If there's actual damage to the structure of the kidney, such as within acute tubular necrosis, or there's damage to the glomerulus, such as glomerular nephritis or pyelonephritis, then that's the intrarenal. That's an example of intrarenal kidney injury. And a good example of post-renal would be with an enlarged prostate that cuts off it's a post-obstruction a lot of times to the urinary system. And that backup can cause the fluid to cause the kidneys to swell. It could also be caused by a blood clot or a kidney stone. So with chronic kidney disease, there are five stages, and the best way to measure, for us, the best way to measure chronic kidney disease, especially in practice, would be to use the estimated GFR. And that's a simple blood test to let you know the function of the kidney. And the kidney happens over five stages, where one stage to the next, so stage one to stage two, whereas stage two is going to have less function than the prior stage. So the early stages would be stage one and stage two, and stage four and five would be the later stages. So anything where you start to notice a decrease in less than 60 of a GFR, you really start to notice those the functions of the kidney starting to fail. By the time you get to stage five, that's usually time for dialysis to start. And we have another POP quiz. So this is going to be, I'm going to set you up with a scenario. This would be in a scenario where you get a consult to teach a patient about a diet for starting dialysis. And the patient will ask you this question. And the patient says, how much protein should be present in the urine? And so you can tell this patient probably started reading up on some of his paperwork on lab values and certain tests, and they're coming up with this question. So your answer to this question, how much protein should be in your urine, is either none. You give a range of albumin-creatinine ratio, which albumin is protein, of 30 to 300, or you say C, more than 300, or you say D, the more protein, the better, in your urine. So the actual answer is none, A. You really shouldn't have protein in your urine. And so in addition to the stages of chronic kidney disease, there's also a measurement of protein, albuminuria. And when you combine the two, when you combine the blood test with the urine test, it forms a two-dimensional chart, and it will also help you kind of determine your level of kidney progression, not progression, but failure. So if you look here as it goes from green down to deep red, even though you may only be in stage three kidney failure, if you have more protein in your urine, that's still cause for an alarm and cause for you to start to consult with a nephrologist. So the controversy with this method is the stages net the blood test, and it missed having blood or protein in your urine. But even with this combination of both of them, the controversy still is that it doesn't show you how fast the kidney progresses. So the goal with acute kidney injury for nutrition management is that you first want to try to treat the underlying cause. So if it's a hemorrhage, you want to try to restore blood flow. For instance, in dehydration, you want to restore hydration. The goal would then to be, if nutrition can't necessarily get to the underlying cause to treat that, then you go into managing the complications of the causes of the symptoms that you're seeing. So with you would want to correct fluid, electrolytes, and any uremic abnormalities. And the other side to that is you want to try to prevent or minimize malnutrition or catabolism, because if someone's kidney is shutting down, there's usually, especially in an acute injury, there's usually inflammation or a catabolic condition, and those side effects can even worsen the condition. And so so nutrition really plays a huge role in somebody's recovery and therapy of acute kidney injury. Dietitians should be the front line and be very present and vocal when it comes to treatment for acute kidney injuries. So the main thing with nutrition management of acute kidney injury, we can go through the different requirements. So with fluid, which I had mentioned before, sometimes there's a decrease in urine output or a shutoff of urine output. And so one of the ways to determine how much fluid is to take the total urine output and add the insensible losses, so about 400 to 600 milliliters to cover what you lose through the GI or metabolism or skin. A lot of times using, if the patient is still having full function of urine output, you could certainly still use a 25 to 30 milliliter per kilogram formula, but there's usually a lot of fluid restrictions in these types of patients, and there's also usually other medications involved. So you want to make sure that you're taking into consideration all other IV fluids in addition to what you're planning on providing. With energy, a patient in an ICU, you can certainly use an indirect calorimetry if you have access to that machine, as long as they haven't started dialysis yet. But a simple equation just of 25 to 35 calories per kilogram based on your goal of weight maintenance or if they are underweight versus if they're obesity, you can calculate how many calories somebody might need. Protein is probably the one that's the biggest debate in terms of in practice. Going through the research, it's pretty clear that the emphasis of protein restriction on a acute injury is no longer necessarily highly recommended. Usually they stick to more of the median range of 0.8 or closer to 1, but you will still find physicians on the floor really trying to cut back on protein. And the one thing that you want to try to be vocal about is that someone who's in acute kidney injury on the verge of starting dialysis, you don't want to restrict their nutrition to try to prolong someone going on dialysis. Restricting someone's protein, causing protein energy wasting, is not really the best care for someone's outcome or care. So if the lowest I would probably want to go down to is 0.6 grams per kilogram, considering the typical range that most people eat is well above 1.2, I would keep it at 0.6 to 1. I think that's still a conservative amount without causing any further malnutrition. If they are moderate to severe malnutrition without dialysis, you can still give 1 to 1.8. And if they start dialysis, then they definitely need more protein, and I would give a higher amount of 1.5 to even 2.5, where, again, some will debate that 2 should be the highest, but you have to remember that some of those dialysis will really pull out a lot of that extra protein, so it's okay to give a little bit more. In addition to the cause of the kidney injury, sometimes they're septic or there's some kind of inflammatory process going on, which requires extra protein to keep that nitrogen balance. So electrolyte management in any type of kidney injury is always especially an acute kidney injury, is always something that you can't just put a recommendation in and leave and come back in a couple weeks. It's ever-changing, and it's something that you want to be on top of, but the main ones usually is sodium, because that has to do with a lot of fluid and hydration, as well as potassium. There's usually hyperpotassium, hyperkalemia with acute kidney injuries, so minimizing that and restricting sodium will help with the fluid and electrolyte balance. Acetate, making sure there's adequate acetate, because metabolic acidosis is always a concern. And then magnesium, calcium, and phosphorus, although phosphorus typically does go high, you want to look at the big picture of that as well, and it's adjusting for the electrolytes that you're seeing, possibly some of the medications that you're seeing, and trying to figure out exactly what's going on with those electrolytes to try to correct them. Once dialysis starts, there's a lot more room for additional fluid, and as well as potassium and other electrolytes, because the dialysis will sort of act like the kidney again. And with dialysis, you can still expect some loss of calcium, phosphorus, and magnesium, but not a whole lot with phosphorus. when you're determining what kind of support to give someone from a nutrition standpoint, you approach it the same way you would anybody going into a hospital. That is still the best way to feed somebody if it's available. And if oral's not available, then enteral nutrition would be the next best, followed by parenteral if enteral wasn't an option. If you do choose to go with enteral, you do not need a specialized formula. You can certainly start with a regular standard isotonic formula. If that doesn't seem to be working and they need a fluid restriction, you can go to a 1.5 formula or a 2 cal per milliliter formula. Sometimes you may want to choose a formula with higher protein because of the dialysis, or sometimes you may choose a specialized formula just because of the calcium phosphorus or what the electrolytes are doing, choosing one with a lower potassium. But usually that's not warranted, and you can usually get away with using a standard regular formula. When parenteral nutrition is needed, you want to watch for fluid overload. Sometimes you can't provide the full nutrition because you are limited to how much fluid you can give somebody. You can still provide a regular multivitamin through the TPN, and then you would want to order a CBC, CMP, MagFos, and check those regularly and daily until those were stable. So using those recommendations for nutrients, we can kind of walk through a case study. So here is a 35-year-old male with no significant past medical history or surgical history. He's 5'11 with a healthy normal BMI of 19. He presents to the emergency department with progressive shortness of breath. The workup diagnoses severe bacterial endocarditis affecting his aortic valve. This patient was emergently taken to the operating room for an aortic valve replacement. Postoperatively, there were complications. He became hypotensive and hemodynamically unstable, which he did not respond to multiple vasopressors or IV fluid or plasma expanders or diuretic therapy, and his urine output decreased to less than 400 milliliters per day. Some of his lab values are shown, and the CO2 is 11, so he is acidotic. So based on this picture, what type of kidney failure would you classify him as? Would you say, A, this is acute on chronic kidney disease, B, metabolic acidosis, second to chronic kidney disease, stage 4, pre-renal acute kidney injury, second to perioperative ischemia, or D, intrarenal acute kidney injury, second to perioperative ischemia? So this one, it's not acute on chronic because when the patient entered the emergency room, he had no significant past medical history. This happened suddenly. The metabolic acidosis is certainly there, but it's not because the patient is in chronic kidney failure stage 4. That would leave you either C or D, and because of perioperative ischemia, because you have a blood flow prior to getting to the kidney, that would be classified as C, pre-renal. So for this young gentleman that just went into acute kidney injury, then they started talking about starting dialysis for him. And so some of the indications for dialysis for this particular patient was there's a non-obstructive oliguria, which is that decrease in urine output. There's still output, but it's severely restricted. The diuretic resistant edema, and the fact that he's becoming severely metabolic acidosis, azotemia, and severe electrolyte abnormalities could potentially come. So in addition to what this patient's presenting, some of the other things that patients could present with that would warrant starting continuous renal replacement would be a drug overdose or just severe hyperkalemia, severe uremic organ involvement, or uncontrolled hypothermia, just to name some of the other reasons as possible indications for starting renal replacement. So within the hospital setting, we are fortunate enough to use something called continuous renal replacement therapy. That allows a slow rate of fluid removal using a slow blood flow rate. And so it's more gentle to the patient as far as removing some of these toxins that are building up. The four most commonly used continuous renal replacement modalities are listed in this graph here. So the first one would be called continuous veno-venous hemofiltration. The second one is continuous veno-venous hemodialysis. The third one is continuous veno-venous hemodialfiltration. And the last two are special cases where it's SCUF and SLED, SCUF being slow continuous ultrafiltration and SLED being sustained low efficiency dialysis. Each one of these modalities will vary based on how they clear the solute, either convection or diffusion, whether they are allowed to use whether they have the access to have additional fluid replacement or replacement fluids, use of dialysate, some of them use it, some of them don't, the duration being over 24 hours or 6 to 12 hours, and the need for anticoagulation. So going through each one of these, just to try to give you a visual, here's an example of SCUF. This is a slow continuous ultrafiltration, so there's no dialysate being used. So here's where blood comes from the person and into this filtered through this semi-permeable filter. And what is filtered out depends on the size of the pores of the filter. And so what is big enough to go through will be excreted, and then the clean blood will be returned back in for circulation. A good case of use of SCUF is when you are not removing a lot of solute, but you want a lot of just fluid removal. So in this case, there's no additional replacement fluid needed. There's no dialysate. And a lot of times, it's just extra fluid removal. A good example of this that I've seen in clinical practice was a real bad graft versus host disease, when the patient was just completely fluid overloaded and they just needed to really get that extra fluid off. So here is continuous veno-venous hemodialysis, which is a traditional one, which does use dialysate. So here you have the access, it pulls the blood, it goes through a filter. And that filter works the same way as the SCUF, where depending on the size of the pores, what gets filtered out, as well as this dialysate is filtered in the opposite direction that the blood is flowing. And this is also going to pull solutes out based on the diffusion. So it's going to go from high to low. And then once it pulls out the solute from the blood, it gets returned back in. Now, replacement fluid is not needed a lot of times in these cases, but if you wanted to use additional fluid, you could. And then using SLED, which we talked about before, the sustained low efficiency dialysis, it uses the same hemodialysis machine. It's just a matter of what kind of goal you are looking to achieve. With the hemofiltration, here is an example of where the blood is being pulled out. It's going through a filter. There's no dialysis. It's going, the blood is being returned, and they're actually using additional fluid here. And then the last one gives you a dialysate, gives you fluid, and it also filters the blood, not only through dialysate, but through a filter. This one uses a lot of fluid. This would be used in a case where you're removing a lot of fluid and a lot of large molecules. And so replacement fluid is definitely usually needed in that case. Now, as in cases where, since I'm a dietitian, I'm never involved in the case of deciding when someone starts dialysis or picking what dialysis to use, but it's always a good idea to be familiar with the different types and, you know, what they're trying to achieve, if they're trying to pull off a lot of solutes, if they're trying to pull off a lot of fluid. It just helps when you're trying to have a discussion in terms of, I need more protein in this DPN. Can I provide extra fluid if you're using the hemodialysis filtration? You have the capabilities of pulling additional fluid off. So it's just nice to be able to be involved in those types of discussions and kind of know what you're capable of doing. So, and this, back to our young gentleman who went into acute kidney injury, the one that presented to the emergency room, progressive shortness of breath, endocarditis, had an aortic valve replacement, and then went into acute kidney injury. So on hospital day number two, they started continuous veno-venous hemodialysis filtration, and they used a 2.5% dextrose-containing dialysate. The patient started having hyperglycemia despite having no history of diabetes, and a nutrition consult was placed. So a couple of things that you're going to approach this with is whether you're going to need to start enteral nutrition or parenteral nutrition, and then what you're going to actually feed this patient. So to calculate fluids, I use the recommendations that I provided earlier to come up with his fluid output. So the fluid output was less than 400, so I put in 300 milliliters, and since that's his total urine output for the day, I added 400 to 600. So that would make it about 700 to 1.2 milliliters. Now he's also getting, if he's getting any replacement fluid, if he's getting any other IV medications with fluid, you're going to want to take that into consideration as far as how much fluid you're actually going to, free water you're going to provide for him. The protein requirements for this patient on dialysis would be 1.5 to 2 or 2.5. Now, I told you earlier that protein can sometimes be a debate, so you might have had one of those intensivists in the unit saying, don't feed higher than 2.5. I'm concerned with acidosis or... So I would compromise. I would still say to try to push it to the higher side if able. And then I would just go with energy requirements of 25 to 35. So at the point that a dietitian got involved, the dialysis was already started. So indirect telemetry would not be able to be used in this particular case. And then it comes down to, well, are you going to start enteral nutrition support or parenteral? And so in this case, I would start enteral nutrition. I don't see any indication why we can't at least try it. So then I went ahead and used a standard isotonic formula. You could certainly use an argument here to use a 1.5 or 2, depending on the fluid status, if we could evaluate the bigger picture of the patient. And so enteral nutrition is the way to go here. But if we read here, the small bowel tube was placed to start feeds. The formula was started, but the formula was not tolerated, abdominal distension, hemodynamic instability. So then protein, parenteral nutrition was started. Despite trying to play around with it and try different things on hospital day number five, we went ahead and started parenteral nutrition. Initiated parenteral nutrition. So when you start parenteral nutrition, you we went ahead and continued the enteral feeds. We kept it to like maybe 5 or 10 milliliters per hour. Tropic feeds still have some benefits, so we didn't want to completely give up on that. We went ahead with parenteral nutrition to get him started on a good nutrition regimen and not delay it any further because of concern for becoming severely malnourished. So when you start TPN, you have to work around the calories from the dextrose. So that was a 2.5% dextrose solution. So you want to make sure that you're able to calculate the calories in the dialysate. And then I would simply look at the labs, adjust the electrolytes per lab. And then the insulin piece, the reason I would specifically want to look at the dialysate and have dextrose is because of the high blood sugar levels that he was experiencing. And I don't want to contribute even further to that by overfeeding this patient. The other thing is I have the option of adding insulin to the TPN. In this particular case, the decision was not to put insulin in the TPN because if for some reason the renal replacement therapy was abruptly stopped for some unforeseen reason, I didn't want that additional insulin to be in the TPN. So then this particular case, insulin was left out of the TPN. So eventually this patient recovered and was able to go home. But again, because of that one hit to the kidneys that the kidneys take, they are somewhat weakened, and this is something that this patient should be aware of to be taking screening his kidneys, being aware of that, and doing everything he can to continue to protect his kidneys the best he can. Because the one side of acute kidney injury that it can lead to is chronic kidney disease. And so now we're going to start shifting gears over to chronic kidney disease. So with stage 1 and stage 2 of chronic kidney disease, there is the nutrition management piece is really just your typical healthy diet that you would recommend to most Americans, the dietary guidelines for Americans. You would certainly promote American Heart Association diet guidelines as far as reducing sodium and saturated fat and increasing vegetables. And then if they are diabetic or have hypertension or cardiovascular disease, you want to control blood sugar levels, control blood pressure, and lower cholesterol levels. It's not until stage 3 that they may start to see some need to change their diet up a little bit. This is usually with protein because you start to see creatinine increase. And so again, we go back to that 0.6 to 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram. I'm not someone that likes to go less than that. The literature really says I don't have to. And I tend to, when I'm counseling patients in an outpatient setting, tend to try to focus more on what they can do. And so as long as they're not going after the ketogenic diet, as long as they're not chasing the high protein diets and going crazy with it or drinking these mega protein shakes, then I'm usually okay with doing a moderate amount of protein as long as they're eating a healthy, balanced diet and doing other things as far as restricting sodium and saturated fat. You got to give them something that they can eat. You don't want them to feel like everything is restricted. Stage 4 is probably when patients need dietitians the most. Dialysis hasn't started yet, and the disease is really starting to progress. And so fluid overload becomes a problem, especially if they have underlying heart failure. That can lead them to a hospital very quickly with shortness of breath heart failure exacerbation. Energy level is pretty standard as far as 23 to 35, being 23 if they need to lose weight, 35 more if they need to gain weight. You want to take into consideration age as well and activity level. And then protein in this case usually does have to be restricted because they're just building up so much waste product and becoming uremic. And then sodium and potassium usually have to be restricted. It's usually getting out the high sodium list, the high potassium list the high phosphorus list and telling them they really have to restrict all of these. And then calcium supplement is okay, but they don't want to exceed 2 grams per day. And checking a vitamin D level and trying to maintain that is important because the long-term side effects of chronic kidney disease affects the bones. And so it's a good idea to start getting them involved with their bone health early on and starting to track that. So here are the nutrition requirements. Just in a nice chart if you want to use this as a resource later on. So we talked about the dialysis for acute kidney injury. Dialysis for chronic kidney disease may actually be a little bit more familiar to you. But these can be in offered in the patient's home, or they can be in a dialysis center. So there's hemodialysis, which is usually given 3 times a week for 4 hours. And if you look here, the blood is drawn from a fistula into the dialysate and into the filter. So a lot of this hemodialysis is the same dialysis that they were receiving in the hospital under continuous renal replacement therapy. It's just that they're pulling out more fluid and they're doing it at a higher blood flow rate than they were under continuous. But these patients are stable enough that they can handle that versus the unstable patient in the hospital. So with peritoneal dialysis, this is a little bit different than what we saw before because it's using the peritoneum as a filter. And the peritoneum is this cavity right here. It lines the abdominal cavity. It's 2 layers. The one lines the abdominal cavity as well as the outside of the abdominal wall. And so dialysate is infused, about 1 liter to 2 liters is infused into this space. And it has a dwell time. It'll just sit there for 4 to 6 hours, and patients will change their bag four to five times a day. Now, peritoneal dialysis is not as efficient as hemodialysis, but because you're giving it daily and continuously, it is just as effective as hemodialysis. The concern with peritoneal dialysis is that you can get peritonitis or hyperglycemia because in the dialysates there is glucose. And the amount of glucose that someone absorbs really depends on the dwell time, the volume infused, and the volume and the amount of dextrose infused. So in a hemodialysis inpatient setting at a dialysis center, there is the option for intradialytic parenteral nutrition or IDPN. And this is usually just a basic protein glucose. You can add lipids, but a lot of times it's just protein and glucose. And some of the literature will call it for malnutrition patients, but the criteria really is that they have a low albumin. And those have to do with the Kidoki criteria of trying to gain better outcomes. I know as dietitians, we tend to stay away from albumin as a marker of nutrition. We all know that. It's been ingrained into us, but it's definitely, like it or not like it, it's a marker of mortality for these patients and worse outcomes. So they use that criteria in a dialysis setting, and if the patients are below the goal is 4, so if anyone who's below 4, they get pushed with oral nutrition supplements. If that fails, and all diet modifications have failed, and even enteral nutrition isn't enough, or even if they are on parenteral nutrition at home, and it's still indicated, they will start them on this intradialytic parenteral nutrition, and they will keep them on it until they get to at least an albumin of 3.5, with the goal being 4. Other indications, too, if they have like a poor wound, poor healing wound, or a big open wound that has a lot of output, losing a lot of protein through that, they can start it. So with IDPN, there is they are able to provide calories, usually 1 calorie per milliliter. It's administered, it's hooked up 3 days a week, so they're only getting it 3 days a week for 4 hours, so it's not a huge amount, but it does make a difference. If a patient has high triglyceride levels, that's another reason why we would avoid using lipids in the PN, IDPN. If there's concern for glucose range, they check a sub-Q blood finger stick, and they use rapid-acting insulin. And the only thing that they will do is they will hold insulin for that third hour of dialysis so that there's not rebound hypoglycemia. If a patient does have some fluid overload issues because they're at dialysis, they can pull that extra fluid off, so it's usually not a problem. But if they needed to restrict fluid and there was glucose concerns, blood sugar concerns, they could use, and as long as there wasn't high cholesterol concerns, they could use lipids as a dense source of calories so that they wouldn't exacerbate hyperglycemia or hypertriglyceridemia. So the advantage of having IDPN is that they're compliant. You know, home parenteral nutrition deals a lot with compliance making sure that they're coming to dialysis, they're there. We know that they're going to get it at least for 3 days for 4 hours. The disadvantage would be that it's certainly not the best way to feed somebody if they're on an oral diet. But again, if albumin goes low, these patients crash fast and they land in the hospital, and the goal is to have better outcomes. And by doing this, it has shown some benefit to it. And so another disadvantage would be that it's certainly expensive. So they're not using this on everybody, just the ones that truly it's indicated in. So at a dialysis center, and we mentioned before that the National Kidney Foundation has established high standards for quality, and that's called KDOQI. And so with those standards, there's they focus on treatment for anemia, and the nurse usually manages that. There's something called KT over V, and the nurse, again, manages that, but the dietitian's role in that piece would be to, because it's a huge team effort at dialysis units, where they would focus on having the dietitian also reinforce the importance of not missing dialysis, coming, and all that. Now, disorders of mineral bone metabolism does rely heavily on the dietitian, and so that's something that they focus on. So with mineral bone disease, I think a lot of us are familiar with osteoporosis and osteomalacia. Osteoporosis being the, as we are young and we are building up our bone volume, our bones get stronger. Once we hit around 20, it sort of plateaus, and then maybe around 50s, we just slowly start to lose that bone strength. With osteomalacia, it's softening of the bones. And then with chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorders, it's a disorder of abnormal calcium, phosphorus, parathyroid hormone, and vitamin D. And it has to do with bone turnover, mineralization. So it's kind of a combination of, it's not a straight osteoporosis and it's not a straight osteomalacia. And the concern is that it can lead to vascular or soft tissue calcification. So when we are dealing with somebody with stage 1 or stage 2 chronic kidney disease, osteoporosis is managed very similar to the general population, where you can go ahead and get a DEXA and you can start calcium and phosphorus and vitamin D supplements. So in a case where you have somebody on parenteral nutrition in early stages, the plan is to make sure you have a standard calcium of at least 10 to calcium gluconate of at least 10 to 15 milliequivalents per day. You need phosphorus for that calcium to absorb, so you want to make sure you're giving at least 20 to 40 millimoles per day. Avoid high doses of protein because exceeding 2 grams of kilogram per day would increase the urinary calcium loss as well as lead to acidosis. So if there is metabolic acidosis and you're not overfeeding the protein, you want to make sure you're supplying adequate acetate. You also screen for vitamin D levels. So the lab value that you would check is called 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And the range for that is you want it above 30. Usually it's between 30 and 80. And because there's no compatible IV form of vitamin D to go in a parenteral nutrition, oral form would have to be the best case. So if we can get a capsule, a lot of times we'll tell the patients to bite it and squeeze it under their tongue and absorb it that way if they're not able to eat anything. And then again, the routine DEXA 1 to 3 years helps you monitor that. Now, with bifosphonates, that's usually something that slows the bone turnover, slows the breakdown of bones. With chronic kidney disease, once that GFR gets below 40, these medications are no longer advised to use. And so that's something that we work with our endocrinologists a lot with in terms of what they want. But most times with chronic kidney disease, the mineral in bone disorder really doesn't get picked up until the later stages. And at that point, it's a lot of times endocrinology doesn't get consulted by nephrology, but it's a very complicated bone disease. So basically, this just kind of walks you through how that disease progresses. So in a healthy kidney, you are going to have a balance of calcium and phosphorus, and vitamin D is going to be activated in the kidneys. With when kidneys start to fail, when you start to see the GFR go down, the kidneys are no longer filtering the extra phosphorus out. So that high phosphorus is going to activate something called a fibroblast growth factor, which is going to suppress the activation of vitamin D. So that's going to lead to high phosphorus values, low vitamin D values, and calcium values, because the low vitamin D inhibits the absorption of calcium in the intestine, so you're going to see a low serum calcium. In a response to that, the parathyroid gland is going to make parathyroid hormone and is going to increase that output to try to stimulate the bones to put out more calcium. When you break down bones to get calcium, you get phosphorus with it. And so that's going to continue to keep that phosphorus level high, which is, again, going to keep that FGF23 high as well, which is going to suppress the vitamin D, which is then going to continue to keep that calcium low. So that's when you start to see a weakening of bones and they become brittle. This extra calcium and phosphorus then can end up in the heart and blood vessels, and it can worsen heart disease. And that's really the clinical consequence of chronic kidney disease and mineral bone disorders, is that in addition to high prevalence of bone fractures, there are more severe vascular, cardiovascular events, and it leads to higher mortality rates. Now, in the later stages of chronic kidney disease 3 and 4, DEXA is no longer recommended. Really, if the ideal way to really understand what the bone quality is, the turnover rate, would be to get a bone biopsy, but that's expensive and very invasive to the patient. So if it's not going to change your treatment plan, it's not necessarily, you're not going to get that. And I would highly doubt that insurance would approve of something like that. They barely approve DEXA scans sometimes. So the best way to monitor this is to check a parathyroid hormone level and to assess that. So with hyperphosphatemia, you are going to want to restrict phosphorus intake either through the diet or through the GPN. If they are on a diet or through enteral nutrition, you can use a phosphorus binder. Calcium binders do the trick as well, but because of the high calcium that in the concern of vascular, the soft tissue deposits, the recommendation now is to stay away from that. Unfortunately, with the price of them, and especially with a lot of people being without a job right now, you may see more people maybe possibly needing to tap into those. So you're definitely going to want to watch your calcium levels. try to avoid calcium supplements and measure and to try to avoid overdosing your supplementation of vitamin D. And if you're seeing a low calcium, check the medication list because there could be some medications on that list causing that. So overall, check lab values at least 3 months. You can change that based on what works for your practice, but check a calcium, a phosphorus, a parathyroid hormone, and a vitamin D. If you're seeing an elevated phosphorus and a low calcium, that's usually causing the high parathyroid hormone. If you're seeing a low vitamin D, this can cause a high calcium and phosphorus level. The vitamin D of choice is vitamin D3, that's the cholecalciferol. And not that D2 couldn't work, it's just that if you're using a higher dose for a month, say if you're giving 50,000 over a month or a week, the D3 has a higher half-life, so it tends to get better results. But you could certainly use D2, you could use it daily or weekly. With home parenteral dialysis or home hemodialysis, you have the option of calcitriol injection, and then if they come to a dialysis center, there's an injection of vitamin D. And again, there's examples of phosphorus binders. So again, with the kidneys, there's so much to talk about. I feel like we talked a lot today. We covered a lot of information, and I probably still have so much more to talk about and could cover. And I'm sure you have tons of questions. So there's definitely some good internet resources out there. The American Association of Kidney, DaVita has a great resource, National Kidney Foundation, and the Renal Support Network are some great resources for you as well as patients. And so I will go ahead and open it up to questions.
Thank you so much, Erica, for that informative presentation. We do have time for a couple questions. There were a few questions specific to the obese patient and protein requirements. Do you use actual weight or ideal weight in acute injury or chronic injury?
I use their actual weight. And I usually go by what the critical, if they're in the ICU, I usually go by what the critical care guidelines go by. Or there's, depending on the situation, sometimes I will adjust for, if it's too outrageous, sometimes I will use the adjusted weight and then go with that and then just kind of monitor how things are going and see if I can increase it.
Okay, great. Do you have any recommendations for specific validated equations for patients with an acute kidney injury over others? Would you prefer Retton-Jones versus Penn State or Mifflin?
The reading when I came across, I'm terrible with the names of the different equations and what goes with what. So when I found in a lot of the literature that it's to go with the easy equation of the 20 to 30, I was very happy because it makes doing calculations easier. But the literature did say that the Harris-Benedict equation did work for the majority of these patients. And that's the only thing that I recall coming across in the reading. But I'm not going to say that the other ones don't work. I'm just not, I can never keep those straight. So I would have to go back and look at the literature to say for sure. But it's not something I've used in my practice.
Well, it's certainly more time saving, that's for sure. There's a question about your case study just for the man with endocarditis. They were just curious as to why you started on ND feeds versus NG feeds.
The reason for the ND feeds was, I believe there was, at the time, there was risk for aspiration, so there was a conversation around it to go ahead and place the ND. I think that was the discussion around why we started the small bowel feeds at that time. I also think that when I was looking through literature, I don't think that I recall needing to be an NG. I think an ND was acceptable.
So there's a lot of questions about the dextrose in dialysate and how much is absorbed. Does it depend on, is it 100% absorbed or?
So with the with hemodialysis, it's not 100% absorbed. With hemodialysis, sometimes it's such a small amount and the time that they're getting infused is so small that I don't even calculate it. With peritoneal dialysis in the home setting, because it's continuous, I do. And then depending on how long or what their blood sugar levels are in the hospital, it's definitely something to look at. So usually the ranges are about 1.2 to 2.5% dextrose. And absorbed is usually anywhere from, I would say, 35 to 45% of that could get absorbed. And then you would just have to figure out if it's 1 liter over 24 hours and it's 1.2% over that 24 hours, and then only, you know, say 35% is getting absorbed. You could do the calculation that way.
Okay, great. We have time for one more. If a patient is vitamin D deficient, do you recommend the same supplementation whether they have chronic kidney disease versus dialysis?
If they have, if they have chronic kidney disease, whether they're on dialysis, then yeah, I would recommend the same. I would base it off of the lab value. I mean, if they have a low value, if the range is 30 to 80 of the vitamin D, and they're just slightly low, I may just start them on a daily, you know, 1,000 unit international units daily. If they are really low, down like 15, then I may be more aggressive and say, okay, let's start with 50,000 a month and then recheck the level in a month. If it didn't budge, then I might go to every other week or weekly until we can get it up. And that's kind of regardless. It's, dialysis wouldn't affect that. I would base it more on what the range is and how they're responding to it.
Okay, great. Well,